Hi, I'm Vernon Trollinger for Optometry Times, and this is 10 questions for Selena McGee, OD, FAAO, President of the Oklahoma Association of Optometric Physicians. Where did you grow up?
So I grew up in a really small town in western Oklahoma. The name of the town is Leedy, and when I say small, I mean small. I graduated with 18 people in my high school class, and 9 of us had been together since kindergarten. My dad worked in oil and gas for 40 plus years. He just recently retired. And my mom is a retired school teacher.
How big was the farm?
Not big. I mean, total, I think between all of the properties, and this was originally it was a third generation farm. So, less than 500 acres. We did wheat and cattle.
So how did you land in optometry?
In a very roundabout way. So I grew up there and I knew I wanted to do something in healthcare. I just wasn't sure what the right fit was, but I accidentally kind of stumbled upon it. So there was a summer between my freshman and sophomore year of college that I spent with my older brother, who at the time was living in Pennsylvania. And so I moved up there with him for the summer. And of course, my parents were like, well, you can go, but you have to get a job. You can't just, freeload all summer. And so I started going through the classifieds. I mean, what 19-year-old has a lot of work experience? And I came across an ad for an optometric technician. And I was like, well, I have worn glasses and contacts since I was 10. That sounds good. And I might have put in my cover letter that I wanted to go to optometry school. And so I landed the job, and a week later I was like, this is the coolest thing I've ever done, and this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. I worked for 2 optometrists that summer in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and these 2 guys, and they were like, oh, and by the way, you have the best optometry school at that time in the country sitting in your backyard that I had never even heard of. And so that's how I got into optometry.
So what was it exactly that drew you in?
So it was interesting because the exam and how you do things is the same, but every conversation and every patient is different. And because it's so varied, I was like, I will never get bored. There's a true relationship here with the patients, because it was a family practice. They had, patients they had seen since they were kids and, generational parents and grandparents. And it just fit. And I was like, this is it. I had considered radiology. And when I explored that, and you're stuck in a lab staring at screens and you never interact with people, that was never going to work. And so this fit perfectly.
Why private practice instead of going into industry or academia?
So I have always been an entrepreneur at heart. And that's the other part that drew me to it, because I could marry those together. And I did actually start in academia. So I worked for my first 5 years of my career in a large nonprofit referral center. The second optometrist they'd ever hired, there was at the time close to 40 ophthalmologists. And I loved the patient interaction. I did not like the bureaucratic slowness of how that played out. And so I knew that was not going to be a long-term fit. And so I left and opened a practice with another ophthalmologist that I have been in a partnership with him for 17 years until actually just recently. And now I'm in private practice, full scope optometry for the first time in 17 years, which is really cool.
Why don't more ODs get involved in the legislative changes?
That's a good question. I had a mentor at the time when I started optometry school. Dr. George Foster was our dean. And literally on the very first day of optometry school, the conversation was around how important it is to be involved at a national level, at a state level. And if anyone has ever heard Dr. Foster's three-legged stool talk, this is where we learned it. And it was the first day of optometry school. And a three-legged stool consists of The school in our state, the association and the members, and then the board of examiners. And if any part of that three-legged stool teeters, obviously the stool falls over. But it came from a mentor, and it was expected from day one. I had no idea that optometry was such a heavily legislative profession. I learned quickly because in 1998, that is when we went to battle over our laser laws. And so I hit the ground running with that knowledge, and I have never looked back. And it's interesting, I never, my mother would like to write this down because I was not interested in any sort of legislative or government. That part of high school civic duties did not resonate with me at all. So the fact that, I'm president of our association and I spend as much time lobbying as I do anything else has been an interesting journey.
What's the hardest thing about lobbying?
I think term limits actually has been a big piece, and there's a good reason for term limits, but it's also very difficult with term limits. Because you've got constant turnover, and so you're constantly educating. And the people that were in the trenches for the big battles, 10, 15, 20, almost 20 years ago, are no longer there. And so it's just a constant re-education. But I have learned a lot in Oklahoma in the sense that we had a state question last year that went to the ballot. And so teaching 162 legislators is a whole lot easier than teaching 2 million voters something. So that's the hardest part. You can never take your foot off the gas.
How did Botox and anesthetic injections win their okay in the state of okay? And how did you get started offering eye rejuvenation?
So it was another one of those kind of serendipitous moments. I was currently working at the time with a technician that had worked in cosmetic, and she'd worked for a plastic surgeon for about 10 years. And we were just talking about, I'm always looking for ways to ensure that the pillars of my business, because it is a small business, that I don't have all of my eggs in one basket. And so, I look at private practice optometry. We have a specialty contact lens pillar. We have, good primary care medical optometry and a dry eye disease center. And then this was a piece that made sense because we do so much stuff around the eyes. And I was like, why aren't we doing this? And so I pulled out our law and looked really closely at it just to double check myself. And it says we can't do cosmetic lid surgery. Doesn't say we can't do functional surgery, and it doesn't say that we can't do cosmetic injections. So I decided to explore it further. I went and took a class, and it was a room filled with MDs, DOs, dentists, RNs. I was the only optometrist. They didn't know what to do with me. They put on the registration sheet that I was a practice manager. And I will never forget the moment that this all turned. There was an MD on the front row that had taken her boards the night before, and the proctor asked her what the muscle around the eye was and what its action was. And she said, I have no idea the answer to either one of those questions. And I was the smartest I was ever going to be after boards, right? Before it all starts filtering out. And so if she doesn't know that, I'm the most qualified person in the room to be doing this. And so the hair on the back of my neck stood up. And I went home and I called the board of examiners and I said, can we do this? And they were like, well, we don't know. Let's talk about it. And so there was a couple of board meetings and I got good news that yes, we can in fact do this. That was about a 4-month battle. And then once I got that, I was like, great. Let's roll, and tried to open my accounts to get the product, and that did not go well either. I couldn't get anybody to sell it to me. So that took another 4 months of a letter, more letter writing, good friends in high places that helped us push this through legal on that side of things, and I finally got Allergan to sell me the product. But I still have two companies at this point in time that refuse. So it's still a battle. Yeah, we're still working on it.
How are your patients responding to you offering ocular anesthetics?
I've been pleasantly surprised because they're like, well, it makes perfect sense. I trust you to do this more than I would trust anybody else because you do know everything there is to know about the eye and everything around it. And so that word to me is very important. And the fact that our patients trust us to do this is huge. And so I've been really, again, pleasantly surprised how receptive they are to this. Typically with injections, you know, you're doing those every 90 days. And so that has been a fun part because you really get to know the patients when you're seeing them, you know, that often.
What's something your colleagues don't know about you?
There's a couple of like fun ones. Yeah, I was an athlete in high school and I held the stolen base record in softball for 8 years in the state of Oklahoma. I used to be
Nice.
really fat. Yeah, I used to be really fast. Not so much anymore. I'm a master gardener and I do a lot of photography, which those two art forms marry well together. So those are kind of my hobbies. And the latest hobby is equestrian sports. So yeah, I decided that my oldest daughter decided she wanted to ride, and so she and I ride together and she does competitions. I just go to ride and
I
learn,
was
but
going to guess polo for a moment, but
maybe someday.
maybe someday. Okay. So what kind of competitions does your daughter do? I mean, is she doing the jumping and to the traditional
Yes.
English things, or?
Yes, she does the traditional English thing. So I ride more dressage style patterns, and she does the hunter jumper with jumping and, you know, all of that fun stuff.
So, what prompted you to become a master gardener?
I have all, so my grandmother and my mother heavily green thumbs. And then, so we always had a huge garden growing up, and we had beautiful just yard. So it was certainly passed down, and I wanted to do that when I was younger just so I could have that skill set. And so it's a long process to get that certification, but I just made it a priority. And I was pregnant at the time with my oldest daughter, and I thought if I don't do this now, I'll never get this done. So that's how that came about. But it was one of the coolest things I've really enjoyed it.
So, do you have a garden, like a vegetable garden at home,
Mine is more pretty stuff, so I do a lot of woody
or?
ornamentals. And I don't do as many vegetables. It's really hard to do it organically, and so other people do that better. So I tend to just hit the farmers markets for the vegetables. Like the house we live in too, I would have a bigger one if I had a greenhouse, but our yard is really small and I don't have enough sun. Like we live in a pretty shaded area and you have to have, you know, 8 to 10 hours of sun to be able to do that well. And so we have a huge herb garden and we have tomatoes and that's as far as my vegetables go.
So what was the process of becoming a master gardener?
So it's through the extension office here in Oklahoma County, but they have classes and it's a 4 month long class session on one day a week from 9 to 4. So you go through all of the classes and it covers everything, you know, fruit trees, turf, woody ornamentals, I mean, everything you could possibly think, insects, all of that stuff. And then you spend another 60 hours at the end of that at their phone bank. And so you answer questions that people call in about and they bring their stuff to you. Hey, you know, my leaves are doing this. What's wrong with it? And so it's, you know, community service too, basically. But once you get through all that, then you're considered a master gardener.
What's something about optometry you'd like to change?
Optometry historically has not done a good enough job about how important comprehensive eye care is. You know, I still have patients now that I, you know, they come in and they have children and we talk about the kiddos. How old are your kids? Oh, they're 9 and 14. Oh, well, do we see them? No, they've never had their eyes checked. They see fine. You know, and my heart dies a little bit inside when I hear that. So that is one thing we have to change in the public space. The second piece is there is going to be a huge gap in care over the next 10 years that optometry has to fill. And ophthalmology cannot fill it. We have to, but if we don't do a good job of stepping up to the plate to fill that, someone's going to fill it for us in the form of PAs, nurse practitioners. Lots of other avenues are going to come into play, and we have an opportunity to really create something awesome in that space if we'll just step up to the plate. So that's what I want to change. I want optometry to be at the forefront of everything eye care.
Any general plan on how to do that?
A couple of ways. So, I mean, we're already, educating the public through different campaigns nationwide. I still think it comes inside the exam lane and educating every single person that walks through your door about comprehensive eye care and why that's important. So I still think you have to do the one-on-one. And at some point, we have got to continue our legislative battles with ophthalmology so that those symbiotic relationships are truly symbiotic. And I have worked with ophthalmology my entire career inside. And when you can check your egos at the door and when you can truly appreciate what the other one brings to the table, that's where the magic happens. But we need MDs to go and be in the OR and do surgical things that they're good at and get good at that so that we can take care of the rest. But you have to build that trust. And there's been just too many instances of that trust over the years being broken because of turf wars. So it's going to have to come, one-on-one with the surgeons that you work with. It's going to have to come from their mindset that, we've been pigeonholed into this, but ophthalmology has to realize they can't take care of it all. And we have an amazing profession and people inside of it that are quite capable of taking care of patients in a way that lets them do what they need to do.
How do you see your role as an optometrist changing in the next 10 years?
I think we're just going to continue to build on what we've done. I think we're going to see more, I think we're going to see stronger pillars in certain areas, and that's mostly going to be on the medical side of things just because of the way the patient demographics are changing. So, the days of just doing refractions and selling glasses are coming to an end, if not already. So, in the way that I practice optometry, which honestly, until I started looking at it nationwide, I didn't realize there was a gap in that there's just some places that you can't fully practice the way that I practice. And I've taken it for granted for a long time that, I mean, I write oral medications every day. I diagnose glaucoma. I treat glaucoma. I do lasers for glaucoma. So over the next 10 years, I would like to just expand what we can do and have more physicians that are able and comfortable to do those kinds of procedures, if you will, that make sense for the patients and make sense for, nationwide optometry in general.
What's your guilty pleasure food?
Ooh. Let's see. I currently have been on this whiskey tour. 3 years ago, I went to Ireland, and when I went, I was like, okay, I'm gonna test this water of Irish whiskey. And so came home and decided to explore the entire whiskey world. So that morphed into bourbon, Irish whiskey, Japanese, etc. And so that's like my guilty pleasure is at the current state is bourbon. I
What's
cannot
your favorite bourbon?
at the moment, like if I had I can't hardly get it. It's Blanton's is my favorite.
Actually, I think I've heard of that, so.
Yes. It's really hard to get in Oklahoma. It's not hard to get in other states, but in Oklahoma it's hard to get. So That's my favorite at the current time.
What got you interested in whiskey?
I guess because of that trip. So when I go on trips, I really try to focus on something that will make that trip memorable, down the road. And, I went to Napa like 10 years ago, and the red wine at my house like exploded. And so when I went to Ireland, I was like, okay, this is a good opportunity. I don't know anything about whiskey. I don't know anything about this world. Let's explore it. And so, I tried everything that I could get my hands on when I was in Ireland, and that just morphed into this ridiculous hobby I have now. But it usually revolves around travel. Like, so that's, yeah. And it depends on where I've been. That's usually, you can follow my hobbies depending on where I've been.
Do you have any regrets?
I wish that at a younger age I had developed a comfort level with being uncomfortable. That I think is really important, and it's come as I've gotten older, and I realize that you can't be good at something when you very first do it, and that is perfectly okay. That's how it's supposed to be. But I wish I had leaned into that much earlier in life.
Now, you were something of a high school athlete, and that strikes me right away as you should be like really familiar with being uncomfortable. So
I know. So I'm really familiar with being uncomfortable, but I am not familiar with not being good at something. And so that's where I have a hard time. Like, if I'm gonna do it, then I want to be the best at it. And you're not gonna be the best at something the very first time you ever do it. And so that taught at a much younger age, and being okay with that and building to that is perfectly fine. But I wish I had learned that younger.
what was the time that you was there a particular instance that you discovered that you had to accept that? Or are you still or just lots of little ones?
Lots of little ones, and I still struggle with it a little bit, but when every time that you pick up, I guess it's been since I've really graduated from optometry school, because when you're in optometry school, you're drinking from a fire hose, and it's okay to not be good at something there, and it's in a learning environment, and so it's okay. It's once you get out and you start practicing that you have to find the right avenues to learn things in a way that makes sense. And so, I've worked with more people across the country, and actually more even local physicians, where we really build off each other. They come and learn something from me, I go to them and learn something from them, and so it's in a learning environment. Those relationships are paramount in your adult career that I don't think you put enough focus in when you're young, because you take it for granted because it's at the school. And so, that would be my, if I had to go back and like tell my younger self, do this, that's what I would tell myself.
Now we're at our last question, and we inflict this one on everyone.
Okay, here we go.
What's the craziest thing you've ever
No, there's a couple. So,
done?
one's optometry related and one's not optometry related. So, whenever I was spending my summer in Pennsylvania with the two optometrists, and I decided that I wanted to do this the rest of my life, I was actually enrolled and playing softball at a junior college in Kansas. And I called my coach 2 weeks before school started and said, I'm not coming back. You're going to have to find a new center fielder. And I applied to go to undergrad at Northeastern State because I thought if I was already there, I would have a better shot of getting into optometry school. I was accepted, about a week before school started. I had never been to Tahlequah, didn't know where it was, had no place to live, knew no one, drove home from Pennsylvania, found a place to live on the way home. Went to mom and dad's, picked up the rest of my stuff, and drove back to school and started at NSU the next week, completely sight unseen. So that's how I started my optometry career, and it paid off because I got into optometry school a year early. And but that's pretty crazy to think about, that I was 19 and did that. And
And
then
flexible as heck, I'll tell you.
the second coolest thing and like scariest thing I've ever done is I hiked the Incan trails to Machu Picchu in Peru. And when you get to Machu Picchu, there's another mountain on the other side called Huayna Picchu, and they only let 400 people on per day. So you have to stand in line at early hours to even be able to get on the mountain. And it's a 1,000 foot vertical. And on one side, it's 14,000 feet down to the bottom of the Urubamba Valley. And so there were pieces there, and the railing, there's no railing, and the walkway is literally about a body width apart. So there was pieces of this mountain I went up on my hands and knees because I was petrified. And but I made it to the top, and at the top you have to army crawl through a cave to get to the very top of Huayna Picchu. And that is the like craziest thing I've ever done, was army crawling through that cave to get to the top of this mountain, and you know, white knuckled the entire way. But I made it, and I've got some of the coolest pictures and the best memories of that moment. But that was probably the craziest thing I've done.
Any pictures of you on that mountain?
Yes, and if you look closely,
Mm-hmm.
because we each took turns like taking pictures. If you look closely, because I'm sitting on a rock and Machu Picchu is in the background, and you can see how far it is down on the other side, that I'm like white knuckled on the rock, like hanging on for dear life, trying to look calm and composed in this picture. Very cool. Trip of a lifetime.
Well, Selena, that's all the questions I have for you today, and thanks for taking time to talk with me.
Absolutely. Thank you. I appreciate it.